Hey, Chris Garlock here with this week's Labor History Today.
It's like, you know, what to wear on casual Fridays, how to get along with your boss, what do you do in case there's an office romance. So nothing about working class people.
Why did so many working class Americans desert the traditional news media in the 1990s in favor of Fox News, talk radio, and Christian broadcasting? It's a complicated question. But our featured guest this week thinks he knows why, and more importantly, he's written a highly acclaimed book about it. This week, we take you to the Heartland Labor Forum radio show in Kansas City, where Judy Ann Sell talks with Christopher Martin, a professor of digital studies at the University of Northern Iowa, and the author of No Longer Newsworthy: How the Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class. On this week's Labor History in 2, Rick Smith tells us about the origins of the Hatch Act, which limits political activity by federal employees. We'll start off the show this week with Florence Reese, who died in Knoxville, Tennessee on August 3, 1996, at the age of 86. Reese was a mine workers' union activist and author of the labor classic Which Side Are You On?, which she wrote after her home was ransacked by Harlan County Sheriff J.H. Blair and his thugs during a 1931 strike. In these days of sustained protests in communities across the country, the question of which side you're on is still very much alive. We begin with Reese, followed by the remix with Rebel Diaz featuring Dead Prez and Raka Ira Science. That's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. Here's the show.
Come all you poor workers, good news to you I'll tell. How the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? We're starting our good battle. We know we're sure to win. Because we've got the gun. Thugs are looking very thin. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? If you go to Harlan County, there is no neutral there. You'll either be a union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? They say they have to guard us to educate their child. Their children live in luxury, our children almost wild. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Gentlemen, can you stand it? Oh, tell me how you can. Will you be a gun thug or will you be a man? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? My daddy was a miner, he's now in the air and sun. He'll be with you fellow workers till every battle's won. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Now all of you know which side you're on, and they'll never keep us down.
We the people are the ones who gonna have to fight. We used to say, which side are you on? Which side are you on? The truth is, we're in so much debt that the only way out is revolution or war. So now the question is, which side are you on? On, 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 on.
Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on, my daughter? Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on?
See, before I draw the line, let me welcome you close to all the folks who knew Obama sold the people of hopes. Gave the money to suckers while our community's still poor. Withdrew the troops but started another war. Colonizing, terrorizing, creating the oil crisis. So they can make a killer, no food and gas prices. Prisons is filling, they trying to lock up the future. Militarized borders and control of computers. Wanting stupid bumping music that ain't healthy for the shortest. Privatizing schools and policemen in the hallways. Can't be dormant, I'm awoken. Rise up, be ready, brought the family with us. us and we hold the machetes.
Riding the fence, too many people be riding the fence. Yeah, you say you ready for war, but are you convinced? I'm not convinced. If you're a rider, freedom fighter, crowd excited, then let's do this. We can make one big united middle finger to the U.S. Give me the bravest and the truest, fuck the hippest and the coolest. We gon' spark this revolution and cross this off our to-do list. Put your foot down if you look down on this criminal system. Put your book down and get shook down like my niggas in prison. They'll be condemning and condoning their actions in one sentence. Make up your mind, you decide, is you a patriot or a menace to society? So riot or sit by quietly. But don't pull out your flag and try to say you gon' ride with me. You flip-flopping like hip-hop, I don't get locked in that trick box. Get got like Big and Pop, shit's got to stop. I am the people, not the pig, I repeat after Fred. So please blow my brains out if I ever forget.
I'm with the independent thinkers. I'm down with the movers and the shakers and the ex-handy drinkers, the non-smokers, the health advocates, the non-voters, the young bloods in the hood training like soldiers. I'm on the side of the tracks with the hood guards, the little child that don't color inside the margins. I don't ride the fence, I cultivate my strength, cause if it ain't about power, it don't make sense. I've been down with Boogie Down since BDP, some brown pride, and black power make RBG. A OG told me choose battles wisely. In the struggle, don't forget your children and your wife. If you don't see me on the podium preaching it, every day I hope my every action is teaching it. Cause revolution is a process, it's not a speech or a panel. Don't bite off more than you can handle.
Slingshots in Palestina, con todos los estudiantes por educación gratuita. I'm with workers uprising and the right to unionize. We ain't crossed the border, so you better legalize. I'm with La Peña del Bronx, I'm still with Vitor Toro. Cause gentrification is polluting my borough. So bro, never, South Bronx forever. Decolonize the block, make your neighborhood better. I ain't down with the rich, I'm more Richie Perez. Don't talk to grand juries or cooperate with feds. I'm with students, doctors, janitors, teachers. We need living wages, but they don't believe us. Moneta, Barreto, Spofford, Hunts Point, my point, my hood, I love. We join forces, forming our deck, we ex. Taking over buildings, rebel DIs for the children.
Politics to sickness, streets express symptoms. Caught up with a quickness, big business pimps them. Scholars play the simpleton, fools play with wisdom. Who will stand and fight back? Who will play the victim? Trials and tribulations, injured generations. Stolen history and outsourced innovation. Babel Tower fell, tribes are at war. The battle story not represented in the score. The game's fixed, most of the faces and names switched. Credit stolen for all science, religion, language, technology, philosophy, and with strangers. They paid in hatred for the knowledge of the ancients. Power in words, actions, guns, swords. Aim Panthers, brown berets, young lords. Pick a side, one sickness, one cure, one love, one blood, one world, but one war.
Why did so many working-class Americans desert the traditional news media in the 1990s in favor of Fox News, talk radio, and Christian broadcasting? It's a complicated question, but our featured guest this week thinks he knows why, and more importantly, he's written a highly acclaimed book about it. This week, we take you to the Heartland Labor Forum radio show in Kansas City, where Judy Ann Sell talks with Christopher Martin, a professor of digital studies at the University of Northern Iowa, and the author of No Longer Newsworthy, How the Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class.
Let's start where you begin the book, which is with Carrier, the Carrier plant in Indianapolis. So in 2016, Trump parachutes in to the about-to-close Carrier plant in Indianapolis to save jobs. Tell us how the mainstream media reported it and what they got wrong.
Well, what's interesting, I talk about that as maybe the best day of the Trump presidency, and he actually hadn't been inaugurated as president yet. On the campaign trail earlier in 2016, before the election, Trump had made promises about saving jobs in Indianapolis at this Carrier plant. And he made lots of kind of hyperbolic statements about it. He was going to save those jobs, but then he kind of forgot about it. And it wasn't until some of the workers who'd been trying for months and months and months to save their jobs there. Carrier's a subsidiary of United Technologies, and they were trying to move all of those jobs south of the border to Mexico at a much lower wage rate. They were kind of desperate, and they just kind of called him on it in a report that ended up being on NBC News. And then Trump realized that he actually had to do something. So he and his vice president-elect, Mike Pence, and Pence actually is from Indiana, where he was and still was the governor at that time, had already declined to do anything for that. He said he'd done all he could. So they ended up giving, with lots of millions of dollars, they ended up getting United Technologies and Carrier to save some of the jobs. And Trump came out, he went to the plant, he never talked to any of the people in the labor union, but went there and praised himself and praised the United Technologies chief executive and said, we saved all the jobs. And it was a couple days later that the head of the union local there realized it only saved about half of the jobs. And he came out and said that Trump didn't do what he said he was going to do. And then kind of in his typical fashion, Trump badmouthed the labor union chief and gave bad tweets to him. But it was interesting in the mainstream media did a really bad job of covering them because they were so taken by Trump, the president-elect and what he was able to do. They just thought, wow, he's just going to almost single-handedly go out and save, jobs everywhere across America. We know now that that didn't happen, by the way, but they really gave him a lot of praise and the benefit of the doubt. And it wasn't until, so most of them actually accepted Trump's narrative that he went in and saved these jobs. And Trump battled mightily to put down any kind of dissent against that. Hence, he was bad-mouthing the labor union chief there, who I actually later talked to. And he just said, Trump just flat-out lied.
That was Chuck Jones, right?
Yeah, Chuck Jones. Yeah, he's a wonderful guy. He's since retired. The narrative that the national news media had fit in with Trump's politics. And so what they were suggesting is that these white male working class workers at the Carrier factory were on the Trump train, that they were just the kind of people that supported Trump and he was rescuing their jobs. So, white male working class Americans were being saved.
And what was wrong with that picture?
Yeah, it was interesting because after I talked with the union people, at Carrier, it turns out that 50% of that workforce is African American and about 50% of the workforce are women. Which, and those aren't Trump's people, presumably by the shorthand that the mainstream media uses for demographics. So to point that out would have actually really disrupted that narrative, because I think the last thing that Trump wanted in terms of his narrative was I saved the jobs of, African-American working class women. That's not his brand, so to speak. But it was disappointing that the mainstream media didn't point that out, that they went with his narrative, and very few came back to actually correct the narrative. There were some good labor reporters that actually did go back later on and actually stayed on into the next year and found out, what life was like for all those people that did lose their job at Carrier. And there were other plants in Indianapolis that also got shut down and sent jobs to Mexico, and Trump didn't say anything about that, and he didn't do anything. It shows kind of the failure. I mean, there's no grand labor policy with Trump, other than to destroy labor. But there's nothing about, no policy about saving jobs. It's just, certain acts here and there that he hopes gets publicity. And unfortunately, the mainstream media provides that kind of publicity far too often.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't always that bad. You do a pretty amazing job in the book of going through the history of what labor coverage was like in earlier days. Could you talk about when it was better and give us maybe an example of how it was better? Maybe talk about the DC transit strike of the 1940s, which you talk about in the book.
This is long before the metro system. If people have been to Washington, D.C., that the whole subway system was built. There were buses and trolley cars that were the major transit in Washington, D.C., in the nation's capital. And it was a private company that actually ran that. So when there was a strike in mid-20th century, it was interesting because the news media covered it, and they didn't make a big deal out of the people, you know, who didn't have a way to get to work or get home. In fact, there was a lot of coverage of people who worked in D.C. who just kind of hitched rides, or they walked in and walked back. And this is during summer in Washington, which if you've ever been there at that time, it's incredibly hot and humid. It's not very comfortable. But everyone seemed to be, the tone of coverage was everyone seemed to be taking it in good stride, that there was a labor strike, and we need to support our fellow citizens. And if it takes, you know, walking 3 miles in high heels and walking back out in high heels, you know, that's what you do, which is very interesting. You know, and what I try to do is contrast that with the tone of coverage that you get, you know, starting in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And if anyone's kind of noticed, you know, a transit strike coverage, so a bus strike, you know, or a subway strike, or a flight attendant strike, or something like that, the news, you know, always focuses in on the consumers and how the consumers are upset about what's happening. So there's kind of a big shift that happens there. One that kind of is accepting and says that these labor people are citizens that we get earlier in the 20th century. And then from the 70s onward, it's really about focusing on the consumer and the consumer's inconvenience and anger. I mean, and if you take that, well, it doesn't seem to be taking positions between labor and management. If you take the consumer's position, it actually is the management position, because what the consumers want is for everything to just stop and go back the way it was, because we liked it that way. And that ends up being a disservice to labor. And actually, it ends up having lots of stories that are anti-labor because people are upset and angry about it. And that's the narrative that they like to tell. Seems like it's neutral, but it's not.
You spend a good deal of time proving to us that the business model of newspapers and I suppose later television was really quite different during the times when there was extensive labor coverage and much more sympathetic labor coverage. And you talk about how that business model changed.
Yeah, what happened is, and I was just curious about this in this book, figuring out exactly what happened, because I knew that the stories had changed, but I wasn't sure like when that happened and why. And so what I found out is that in the late 60s and early 70s, most of the major newspapers around the United States started to, you know, conglomerate. So there were big groups that formed, and those chains of newspapers were publicly traded on the stock exchange. And that starts to change. Now, not every newspaper was pro-labor. There were lots, for example, the Chicago Tribune or the LA Times out in Los Angeles, where they were owned by, you know, these newspaper magnates who were very much against labor and for decades had been against labor. And in a lot of cities, there were, you know, larger cities, there were multiple papers, and that actually, so there were actually some that were more, you know, more working class than others. I mean, to the situation we now have where in most markets in America, there's just one newspaper.
Right.
And usually that newspaper is owned by a big chain, you know, be it Gannett, which actually just merged with Gatehouse, another big chain. Those newspapers, you know, once they became publicly traded, they decided to, in the late 60s and early 70s, to take kind of a different focus. So instead of focusing on the mass audience, like most of them had, they decided to go upscale because the advertisers, they thought, would like that. So they started stopped delivering papers to, you know, to certain people in the inner city and to very far outlying rural areas because that was expensive. And they just focused mostly on people who were suburban and who were kind of middle class or upscale. They wanted those upwardly mobile people. And in doing so, you can start to see the narratives of the newspaper chain change and also the fall off of the labor beat. It starts in the 70s and slowly dwindles out over the next few decades. And so the newspapers don't really know how to cover labor or working class issues on a regular basis. And when they do cover labor, it's like we just talked about, they usually, you know, there's not a labor beat reporter. There's someone who goes out and they talk to someone who's angry that there's a strike because it's disrupting their lives. And that's the story. And if it doesn't affect consumers, it's likely it won't even be covered at all. So that becomes a real problem. And, you know, so when I say no longer newsworthy in the title of the book, it's that they deemed working class people, whether they're members of labor unions or not, those people were no longer newsworthy. And there's some really big impacts that then come out of that because they really forsake that audience. what newspapers start doing is focusing on more on business news. So the business section, starting in the 70s and 80s, start, you know, really plumping up at newspapers. There's more business news later on in cable. There's business news channels. There's magazines like Money Magazine. You know, and all of these are catering to upwardly mobile people and this idea of, you know, people who are interested in doing personal investment. So, you know, people in the idea that they can start trading stocks by themselves. I mean, that you know, legally was started happening in the 1970s. And although the majority of Americans do not own stocks, if you read the newspaper or watch CNBC or something like that, you would think like everyone does that. So that's one thing that changed. And then on the labor coverage, instead of talking about working class people, there were these lifestyle columns that started up at newspapers across the country, which really focused on white collar workers and who work in office suites. And it's topics like, you know, what to wear on casual Fridays, how to get along with your boss, what do you do in case if there's an office romance. So nothing about working class people, you know, and which is, I think, forsaking a lot of the audience too, right? 80% of the people in America have working class service jobs, 12% have working class jobs in manufacturing or mining or something like that. And those are the majority of people in the country. Let me
interrupt you a second. Sure. So are you saying that, first off, well, I guess the two questions that kind of hook together. One is, would you blame this change in the way the media covers labor to being a factor in the decline of unions? And secondly, is it also a factor in what we're seeing today, which is the decline of newspapers?
I think it has a hand in both of those things. I mean, one, in the decline of unions. I mean, unions were still strong through the 70s, and there's actually been a lot of interesting new books about that. But I think, you know, imagine if you, as just a citizen, if you're not hearing news for a long time, for years and years and years, from the 70s on, about working class people and labor unions, it's as if they don't exist. You know, we talk about journalism as being so important and fundamental to democracy in America, but then imagine, you know, that thing that's so fundamental isn't talking about working class people and labor unions. So it seems like it's not an effective thing, and it's probably not even thing that you even think about. So that's a problem, and I think it actually hurt newspapers as well. I mean, they really gave up on their entire audience, and we're going for this much smaller upscale audience. And that works for a while, but especially as we start getting into the internet in the 1990s, and that same upscale audience starts going to other things, they've really forsaken the working class, and it's, you know, it's going to be really hard to get them back.
So what filled the breach? Because it's not like the working class doesn't consume media. What arose in its place?
Well, this is another interesting offshoot that I think really affects our politics in America, and one that I don't think too many people have explored. But so we're at the situation in the 70s where news industry really kind of has forsaken the working class. Part of the work, now the working class is very broad, and it involves men and women and white people and people of color. But part of the working class, and this is mostly white males, get picked off by another ascendant media. And so we have in the 1970s, we have CBN and the Christian Broadcasting Network, which starts appealing to them on cultural issues. In the 80s, we get talk radio, and which is nearly all conservative, starting with Rush Limbaugh. In the 90s, we get Fox News. In the 2000s, we get lots of internet sites like Breitbart. And they specifically appealed to the white working class. In fact, I did another thing that I wrote last year, which talked about Fox's audience. And the most interesting thing about the audience for Fox News is their whiteness. It has the whitest audience of any network on television, which is just amazing. And that actually talks about a lot what they did there. The other interesting thing going with that, of course, if you follow politics, that audience for the white working class, that conservative media audience, is the same group of people that the Republican Party was also shifting to, you know, starting with Nixon in the 1970s, where he wanted to get the hard hats and drive a wedge, you know, into the Democratic Party.
And there's an incredible amount of research that you put into this book. And one of the things that fascinated me later on in the book is your examination of the use of various terms. You do some research on the dropping out of the term working class in the media and the substitution of the term working families. And can you comment on that? And then I want to ask you about job killers.
Oh, yeah. You know, I looked at presidential nomination speeches by candidates going all the way back to Eisenhower in the 1950s. What's interesting, if you go back and read what Eisenhower said, I mean, he sounds like a pro-union Democrat in comparison to everyone else since then. So, and he actually, you know, saw that for America to do well, you had to really pay attention to the working class and unions. And at that time, there was, you know, a pretty powerful unions and a decent amount of labor peace. What you start to see through the 60s, and then especially by the time you get to Nixon in the late 60s and into the early 70s, is the absence of this term working class. So we're not invoking class politics anymore. And then talking about working families, it becomes, that's really kind of softens things and kind of gets out of talking about the fact that we do have unequal classes in America. And families is different. I mean, anyone who works and is in a family can be a working family. So that really kind of strips class out of it. And I think to the disadvantage of the working class, because it's not like they're being identified for the predicament and the power relationships they have in society anymore. And that's adopted by both Republicans and Democrats.
And even the AFL-CIO.
Yeah.
They use that term also, working families. As you point out in the book, it reduces the family to a unit of consumption.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, we're almost out of time. And I'm going to just say that if you want to learn about the term job killer, you're going to have to read the book. Because I want to ask you how the bias in the media today is showing up in the midst of the pandemic. And we only have like a minute left. So,
well, I mean, it's interesting because there's this term essential workers. And I think what the pandemic has done is really kind of open people's eyes is thinking these people who essential workers are for the most part, working class people are working longer hours in much more dangerous situations than the rest of us who aren't essential workers. And I think it's really helped people see and brought a lot of attention in the news media to what's really happening. The fact that these people, if we're going to be calling them heroes, maybe we should be paying attention to how much they're paid. Maybe we should be paying attention to the safety of their working conditions, to their health care. I mean, those things are really important. So I think coming out of this pandemic, I think there's a lot we have to reckon with, and I think it's been brought to the forefront, which is a good thing.
Any quick tip on how labor can get its voice back?
Well, I think labor needs to, you know, use this opportunity to say, you know, we need to take care of people. If we're going to call people heroes, let's pony up and let's give them, you know, good working conditions and health care and the pay that they deserve.
Great. Thank you so much, Christopher Martin. The book is No Longer Newsworthy, How the Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class, and it's from Cornell, right?
That's right.
ILR Press. Thanks, Chris.
My pleasure, Judy.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1939. That was the day that the Hatch Act was enacted. The law was named after Senator Carl Hatch, a Democratic senator from New Mexico. The Hatch Act limits political activities by federal employees. One of the reasons the law was passed was due to allegations of corruption by the Works Progress Administration. The WPA was a key program of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal plan to put people back to work during the Great Depression. But critics of the WPA alleged that the program was being used as a form of political patronage, and that the jobs were exchanged as a way to secure votes for the Democratic Party. Although an investigation found no conclusive proof of the allegations, Congress decided to act to define what was appropriate political engagement for a federal employee. Except for the president and the vice president, all federal employees and employees of the District of Columbia must follow the Hatch Act guidelines. Under the Act, federal employees cannot use the authority of their job to interfere with an election. They cannot be a candidate to a public office in a partisan election. They cannot participate in political activity while at work, or while wearing a government uniform or driving a government vehicle. But the Hatch Act does not completely stop federal employees from participating in our political system. If they are off the clock, federal employees can still attend political rallies, contribute money to candidates, campaign for candidates, and help register voters. Ensuring the individual rights of free speech and elections free of corruption can be a difficult balancing act, especially for the thousands who call Uncle Sam their boss. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. And even better, if you like what you hear, please like it on your podcast app and pass it along. You can be part of Labor History Today by reading a labor history item. Just shoot us a note at laborhistorytoday@gmail.com. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. Editing today by Patrick Dixon. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Chloe Daniel, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history. And see you next time.